So good morning, everybody. That's Luca Lodi. Thanks, Chris, for the presentation. I'm from the University of Trento, which is in the northeast of Italy, in the Alps. I'm a PhD student there. And what I want to tell you about today is some research ideas, some ways that I think are worth exploring to detach ourselves from classical vulnerability risk assessment and try to move to something more internet scale, just to have a broad idea of what the situation is out there. So what are the objectives of my research? Finally, what I want to allow policymakers or vendors to do is to formulate sentences like this one. So maybe the vendor has a set of vulnerabilities that it needs to fix, and maybe with this methodology, what it can do is say, if I fix this group of vulnerabilities, then the risk for my customers as a whole will decrease by a certain percentage, 55% or 80%. Now, if we fix this group plus another part of vulnerabilities, maybe this risk will decrease by 60%. So it's not really worth it. So try to give some quantitative measure. Because now risk measures for vulnerabilities are more or less in this form, are some sort of strange combination of vulnerabilities, time the COSS score, normalized by the number of machines that have these vulnerabilities on, plus some other things that are really arbitrary completely. And it's not really clear how these translate for real risk. The disclaimer here is that this would work only for untargeted attacks, for all the automated scenario out there, so for exploit kits or anything that is not really targeted against one particular attacker, one particular victim that the attacker wants, but against the general population of users. So how I intend to proceed with this? I have a plan with three tracks. In the first track, I will focus mainly on what we as a community already have. So basically the COSS score, try to understand how actually it does work for the job it does as a risk matrix. And try also to understand what the data sets are that are out there that we as a community normally use are there for, what the data that is there means. Then I will move on and I will try to detach a bit from what the COSS has allowed us to do until now and try to introduce some context variables for the exploitation that would help me better assess what the risk is for the vulnerabilities, and we will see how I intend to do this. And finally, also use trends that come, the trends of attacks that come from attack tools traded in the black markets and so on, and see how these affect the final risk for the user. So for the first track, as I said, is centered on the COSS. The COSS is nothing but a series of expert judgments on a number of characteristics of the vulnerabilities. So what I want to try to do is to see if some combination of these characteristics may help us in marking vulnerabilities that are interesting for the attacker, for the actual exploitation. So an hypothesis that one would make is, for example, if a vulnerability is very complicated to exploit, but the impact on the final victim system for the attacker is very little, then maybe it's not worth it. So it should represent lower risk. So hypotheses like these are those that I will verify during my research. And also, of course, the COSS score. Try to assess how good it is at the job it does. Of course, this is a lot of empirical research, so I need a lot of data. And this is basically what I've been collecting so far. I'm relying basically on five different data sets, a couple of which are pretty popular. You see them in most academic studies out there, and other three are a bit more peculiar, maybe. So the NVD is the National Vulnerability Database, contains the universe of vulnerabilities, let's say. ExploitDB contains the proof of concept exploitation code for vulnerabilities that are released by security researchers. Now, this is proof that evidence that a proof of concept exploitation code exists, but is not evidence of the actual exploitation. The actual exploitation, its evidence, is contained in the same dataset, the third one. It's basically a collection of vulnerabilities that Symantec detects as exploited in the wild by all their sensors worldwide. So if a vulnerability in SIEM, it means that it has been exploited somewhere in the wild. Attack volumes against these vulnerabilities are contained in the fourth dataset, the WINE dataset. So not only I have the data on the vulnerabilities that are actually exploited, but also the volumes of the attacks against these for the final users. This is possible thanks to my now 1 year long collaboration with Symantec, with the WINE data sharing project, and the data is there. And finally, there is Zkits, which is our dataset, a dataset that I started a year ago at the university, and now I'm maintaining it with the help of some colleagues. And basically, it's a substantial expansion on Contagio, exploit pack tables, and all these tables that report exploits, vulnerabilities that are bundled and traded in the black markets. So here we have a lot of data. We have data on vulnerabilities. We have data on white hat markets for vulnerabilities. We have data on real attacks, on volumes of attacks, on costs of vulnerabilities and of tools. So we can do a lot of empirical research here. We can do modeling of exploitation. We can correlate market cost of vulnerabilities with chances of exploitation, or how long the exploitation lasts according to what tools the vulnerability or the exploit is bundled in the black markets, and so on. So to give you an idea of how the data sets look like, this is a map of our data sets. Areas here are proportional to the number of vulnerabilities. So the big square, to give you a brief overview, this is MVD. This is the universe of vulnerabilities. ADB is there on the top left. These, you see, are already much less. So proof of concept exploits are much less than the number of vulnerabilities that are released, of course. SIM is in the top center of the figure. You see that it does not overlap ADB consistently, markedly. Actually, the great majority of exploits that you find out there are not released with a proof of concept exploitation code. So attackers probably don't use exploits in ADB to attack real users. And Zkits is the small square in the middle there. You see that it overlaps SIM most of the time. So if a vulnerability is in the black market, it is probably going to be exploited. How CVSS-wise, the distribution, I mapped colors into categories of CVSS score here. The cyan color refers to low CVSS, which is below 6. Medium is orange, between 6 and 9, and above 9, that is the high CVSS, which is red. Now, the lower and the medium scores are not particularly interesting for now, for the purpose of this talk. Let's just say that the low CVSS are most common in MVD, and that security researchers tend to publish proof of concept code for medium vulnerabilities, which makes sense because if they find vulnerabilities with too low impact, the revenue that they get from the vendor is too low, so it does not make sense for them. The point is that with the high CVSS, and this already underlines the problem that I was talking about at the beginning, if it really, the CVSS really matches risk of exploitation, you see that the greatest majority of vulnerabilities that are red are outside of SIM. So a whole lot of vulnerabilities that the CVSS marked as risky are not used by the attackers. And if you look at the other way around, so what vulnerabilities are in SIM, you see that only half of them are red. The remaining are either low or medium score vulnerabilities. So let's say that the CVSS score looks like it's not doing the proper job at identifying the vulnerabilities that are attacked, and also not the job at identifying those that are not attacked. So as a risk matrix, it looks a bit faulty. But this is very observational, so let's try to give some quantitative measure of this. For this, I take from the medical domain. There you have a lot of tests, right? Because people get sick, and the tests need to tell what people are sick and what people are healthy, not to make them have treatments that are expensive or dangerous. So there are, in the medical domain, there are a couple of metrics that they use to check for the goodness of a test. With these are the sensitivity and the specificity. The sensitivity is basically the capability of the test to detect that a person that is sick is sick. So how good is the test at identifying true positive versus all the healthy people? The specificity is the other way around. It marks people that are healthy, so they don't need treatment. For us, it's the same with vulnerabilities, right? We have a test, the CVSS, that tells us what vulnerabilities are more likely or should be higher concern for you, that have to patch them, for example. And it marks them as high risk, and we want to see if this high risk really is means exploitation, higher chance of exploitation. So if we look at the numbers, the sensitivity is quite high, meaning that most vulnerabilities that are exploited do have a high CVSS score. The problem is that the specificity is very, very low, because 20% of specificity means that out of 4 vulnerabilities that are not going to be exploited, 3 of them, so 75% of them, have a high CVSS score. So this is a bit of a generate panic test, basically, because it marks every vulnerability as high risk. So of course, the sensitivity gets higher, because if you pick a vulnerability actually exploited, then the chances that the CVSS score is high. But the specificity remains much low. This actually gets a bit better when we consider the black markets. So with the black markets and the CVSS score, the specificity goes up to about 50%. It's one vulnerability out of two, it's already better, but still quite far from something that would be optimal. To give you an example, and to see how in security we are far away from what the medical domain is able to do, this is a very popular test for pregnant women above 40 to test for their chances of having a baby affected by the Down syndrome. It's a triple blood test. It's a very famous test for these things. And you see that the sensitivity is quite low because most women have healthy pregnancies. And so even if you have a low sensitivity in percentage, the amount of women that you miss is very little. But the specificity is very high because most vulnerabilities are not exploited. So as much as most women do have healthy pregnancies, so you don't want to generate panic and make people patch every single vulnerability or get through many medical exams that are very expensive or maybe dangerous. So the CVSS looks like it's not really working very well. And why is so? Remember that here we're using it as a risk matrix. So actually we're using it not as the technical assessment it was made to be, but as a risk matrix. And as any risk matrix, it is a product of an impact times a likelihood. Now, if we look at the likelihood in the CVSS score, in the CVSS-based score, this is the exploitability. If we look at how the exploitability is distributed in the data sets, this is an histogram. You see on the x-axis, there is the exploitability score from 0 to 10, and on the y-axis, there is the frequency. And you see that it's basically always above 9, so the likelihood of exploitation is always the same for any vulnerability, no matter what data set you're looking at. So everything is equally exploitable, which means that we completely lack of a real characterization of what a likelihood of exploitation is. So this is where the second track of my research plugs into. Basically, I want to move away from the CVSS technical assessment and try to see what are the occasions, what are the set of choices that an attacker has. And I want to do this from an economic perspective. So what I want to do is implement an expected utility model, basically, that given a set of choices or vulnerabilities that the attacker may choose to exploit, predicts that he exploits the one with the highest expected utility. So hypotheses that can be verified here are, for example, if an exploit is less expensive in the black market, then it should have higher expected utility. Or if the attacker has already another exploit for that set of software, then why exploit the other vulnerabilities? After all, if you have a buffer overflow with a execution of remote code, why do you need to exploit others? If that works, you use that one. And so on. So for this, I will keep you posted. There is much work that we're doing there on this topic, so we will see what turns out. And finally, the third track, I will correlate data from the WINE dataset from Symantec on attack tools and see how these attack tools that are traded in the black markets, how much and with what trend do they deliver attacks to the final users. This then I can correlate with the OurKits dataset, which is the dataset of vulnerabilities from the black markets that we've been collecting, and make a better assessment of the final risk for the user, even in function of what vulnerabilities are traded in the markets. So this basically actually closes it. I thank these people, colleagues, and supervisors. And if you have questions, I guess this is done. Thanks.
Hi, Rick. This is Rick Farrow. Hopefully I'm awake enough to say this. So you said that when the prices were low on the black market, that indicated what exactly?
Excuse me?
When you say the price of an exploit is low on the black market, mm-hmm. and that indicates that...
It may indicate that the attacker is more prone to choose that one to buy instead of buying another one or making one himself.
Okay.
And because this is all data that is available, basically, I mean, the black markets are not really open, but can be monitored somehow. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're doing there. So we do have this. It's not that hard to have it. So it's not intelligence that is extremely expensive to gather, nor extremely expensive to manage. So having this data is quite easy and may actually give us a better perspective on what attackers' choices are and how expensive the choices are for them.
Yeah, okay, because I was thinking that I guess I was flipping it on its head that the rarer exploits, the ones that are more expensive because they are rarer, they're not being used as much, would be more interesting, but that's for targeted attacks. So
yeah, it is, or maybe, you know, for 0 days or very new vulnerabilities, but many, many vulnerabilities traded in the black markets and that we find actually exploited right now are 7, 6 years old, maybe.
Okay.
So there is a big discount factor, and this also can be taken into account.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Stefan Savage, UC San Diego. So first of all, let me say I love this topic. I think this is a great area of work. So to follow up on Rick's question, though, so traditionally the reason why we think of 0 days as not being of interest to the broad exploitation market is because they lose their value once they are disclosed.
Sure.
And so they consequently are the kinds of things you stockpile and use for targeted attacks and so forth. But there's been this this new business model that the author of Black Hole Punch introduced about a year ago with the release of Cool Exploit Pack, where he basically created a multi-tiered service where Cool Exploit Pack cost significantly more, $10,000 a month to run, but he then reinvested that money in purchasing 0 days for that clientele. And there's some evidence that that business model actually was successful in bringing 0 days into the broad exploitation market. So I'm curious if you think that changes in these business models are going to unbalance this kind of analysis.
Yeah, surely they do affect it. That's a great question, yes. Still, I mean, according to the data that we have around, and actually there is a report just released by Symantec that shows that they exploit the 0 days that are out there are quite little. I mean, it's still about, we're talking about 15 overall in the history for broad attacks. So the problem does exist, and of course, gathering this kind of data is much more complicated because getting into dark code is probably more complicated than getting into other communities. But we can still add value to this. And definitely, I mean, that's the problem with game theory in general, right? The defender always moves first, and then the attacker adapts to your defensive strategies. So, I mean, it's a chase game, and it's always been. So, but yeah, that's a good point. And actually, maybe that's a good idea for us to explore better in our work there.
So I was wondering if you could comment on the pricing that you see with, for example, the exploit or the vulnerability rewards programs that Google runs or any of these things, and if there's any sort of correlation that you can observe between the pricing that Google's, say, paying for these exploits and how much they might actually be worth, or if there is no relationship, or if you think that the vulnerability rewards pricing will provide any good insight, I guess, into this.
Well, I find that the Google, I would say that the average Google budget to spend on vulnerability is far higher than any budget that an attacker may have to buy an exploit from the black markets. So the exploits that you find in the black markets are very, very little in value with respect to what Google is fine with paying. It pays up to $30,000, I think. But that's also the point. If you look at how the Google rewards the vulnerabilities, it's basically only based on the impact. So there is no real risk metric for this. So there is a variable that is lacking here. Of course, for them, maybe it's not a big problem because it's Google, and probably they can just afford to invest $100,000 per year for vulnerabilities. But I only have a gut feeling. I can only give you some, rule of thumb. And no, I don't think there is any correlation between what exploits you see in the black markets, their prices there, and the prices that are awarded by Google, because they're completely different processes for different targets, assessed in a different way. And so it's hard to assess it. But also this one is interesting. if they price the same things that we do. It's interesting.
I had a couple perspectives on this I was wondering about. The first is the defenders have their own economic considerations and likelihood of exploitation, and whether something is exploited has very different implications for different defenders. I'm wondering how you think that that might fit into this overall framework.
Yes, you're right. Definitely, what one has to do is to also assess what is the risk for its own infrastructure, for its own particular moment. For example, a vulnerability in a particular asset can be much more dangerous than the same vulnerability on a different asset. This is what the CVSS environmental metrics tell you to do. But if one looks at what the standards out there tell you to do, think of the NIST SCAP protocol, think of the PCI DSS for credit cards, all they tell you to do is to use the base score and fix vulnerabilities above 4 or above 6 or above 7. So yes, it is something that must be taken in consideration and that does not permeate through this model, in which I basically only look at the attacker. But it can, of course, be expanded as a discounting factor, for example, for the risk calculated by this model according to your particular deployment of your own assets.
Yeah, I mean, in abstract terms, sure. But what always throws me off balance with this sort of modeling is to actually parameterize it for a given situation is we have no idea how to do it. So, you know, how does the defender actually put together a correct assessment of the implications of, right? This seems really hard.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's usually heuristics, right? I mean, it's how they build the CVSS score in the first place. You just try to make the math turn out at the end of the day. The problem is that so the CVSS is definitely sound in the sense that the technical assessment makes sense, but the number that comes out is not necessarily correlated with what you should think of the risk for your assets. So the idea is just to change this model and to make other heuristics, basically, not to change the number from 0 to 10, the way it's calculated necessarily, but to change the process that generates this model, this number, which in my case, for this case, would be what the attacker, for what is more convenient for the attacker to do, rather than just the technicality of the vulnerability. Then combining the two is always possible, but this is the next step.
Go ahead. Actually, that was pretty much my same question. Have you attempted to actually define the temporal and the environmental metrics for to combine those? Because, I mean, it should come as no surprise that the base scores are, you know, pretty
much. Yeah, sure. So most of the work I've done so far is based on replicating aims at replicating what normal customers do around. And what they do for compliance is using the base score. There is not much you can do about it. Actually, what you can do, and this is, for example, I think what Qualys does for PCI's DSS compliance, is they have a whole team of people that have to justify every vulnerability that they don't fix that would be required from the standard to be fixed. And the standard tells them, indeed, use the base score. So if they don't want to use it, they have to spend much more money to, no, not much more money, but invest a lot of hours and manpower to develop the documentation that justify this decision. So the temporal and environmental matrix are not really used out there. So the here are not considered. But the temporal especially, I want to plug it into.
Right, but I mean, I would assume those would help correct some of the likelihood scores of, you know, I mean, that's really what those two additional metrics are focused on. I mean, what is the likelihood that this will be exploited? You know, what is the value of this target, you know, to the attacker?
Yeah,
so it seems like leaving those two metrics out, you know.
Surely it adds more value to the quality of the CVSS, but not to the situation as it is now. This is my focus. Because everybody uses the CVSS base, and nobody uses the temporal, and especially the environmental, which I cannot assess, by the way, because I would need the data for every single asset out there. So we're using the base score for this reason. But for temporal, I agree with you. I totally want to see how the things go with that.
I think we're out of time, or one more? So I'm also, as a empirical researcher, I'm really interested in the problem here of data quality. And you know, you've got a ton of data and it's juicy stuff, but it's hard for me to figure out, does it skew the conclusions, you know, because of the nature of how it's gathered?
Definitely. I mean, for example, I mean, definitely in the sense that what allows me to do, basically, if I just look at this map, let's go back to the map a moment. So this map is not a real map. So this map says what is the perspective of Symantec for exploited vulnerabilities. But actually, the numbers that I showed you here, and I didn't go through it because I didn't have time for that, but so these are generated by a case control study in which basically we take every vulnerability in CMET cases. So for example, for what software do they affect? And this, of course, is some software that Symantec covers. What years these vulnerabilities were published? So this also gives a frame, temporal frame for Symantec's detection of this. And we pick from every other data set vulnerabilities that are similar, so that we are sure that we're comparing pairs that are not apples and oranges, right? And this is what the medics do to see, for example, if smoking habits are, you know, cause cancer or not. You cannot test every single people in every single country of the world. So maybe they did, one of the main studies was made in London, in an hospital there. And what they did is just they take people from London, and then because they're comparing comparable pairs, you can extend the conclusion outside of it. Still, this is for the population, not for the targeted.
Okay, let's